Nuclear bailouts. There is nothing the nuclear industry likes more than money, money, money. And they're so good at conning their way into absolute piles of it. They claim they have a problem, or they are a solution. And the only thing that will help them is literally billions of dollars in state and federal funds. And somehow, these nuclear manipulators have managed to get legislators, politicians, federal and state agencies to do their bidding. Lo and behold, they get all the funds they're seeking and more without any mandate on that money that they use it for actual needs, like safety. All of which escapes one's notice until you thankfully hear from a genuine expert, someone who has been battling and keeping track of these nuclear ripoff artists for more than 30 years. And he tells you,
the safety risks and the nuclear bailouts are kind of flip sides of the same coin. These very dangerous reactors would thankfully close down. We would have dodged catastrophic bullets, except for the fact that, no, we're going to keep them going with massive infusions of public money. I call it radioactive Russian roulette. And guess who's paying for the game? The public is paying for the game unwittingly and also being lied to, like we've talked about, from the nuclear propaganda, that it's all safe, it's all clean, it's going to solve the climate crisis.
And it's not going to do any of those things. Nuclear is the opposite of any solution to the climate crisis. So when Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog for Beyond Nuclear, puts together the picture of all the bailouts and tax breaks and concessions the nuclear industry has been racking up, and exactly how much it's costing all of us, with no end of the nuclear money pit in sight, you begin to understand how we are being sucked dry to support that dirty, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a powerful roundup on all the many ways the nuclear industry is manipulating this country into hemorrhaging billions upon billions of dollars, that's with a B, to keep them happy. We talk with Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog for Beyond Nuclear, who for more than 30 years has been going at it, hammer and tongs, fighting the nuclear juggernaut, and quite often winning. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, the monthly ICANN update from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, with Alistair Burnett reporting from their Geneva, Switzerland headquarters, and more honest nuclear information than can be found in a $60 Bible. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out here in America with some urgency. An effort to extend and expand the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, to people exposed to radiation from federal nuclear testing and uranium mining was not included in the $1.2 trillion funding package that was signed by President Joe Biden last week. This despite continued bipartisan support and a late push by the White House to extend RECA before it expires on June 7. The fund, which has been in place since 1990, pays out lump sums to qualified people who have been diagnosed with certain cancers and other diseases if they lived and worked in designated places at specific times. Senate Bill 3853 to extend RECA for 6 years has passed, and would offer first-time compensation to communities impacted by the atomic bomb test in New Mexico, as well as residents of Alaska, Colorado, Idaho, Kentucky, Missouri, Montana, Tennessee, and Guam. It would also cover areas of Nevada, Utah, and Arizona not currently covered by RECA, and will include additional uranium workers. Now the bill is being sent to the House, and the push is on to get it passed before it expires on June 7. Organizers have issued an action alert and ask that you call and write your U.S. Congress member and urge them to vote for RECA. Regarding the waste storage issues, on March 27, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans issued a rule vacating the license, which had previously been approved by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission in May of 2023, for the construction and operation of Holtec International's Consolidated Interim Storage Facility in New Mexico. This ruling follows closely upon a ruling by the Fifth Circuit to uphold its August 2023 ruling that the NRC license for Interim Storage Partners' Consolidated Interim Storage Facility in Texas was illegal. These two dumps, which were intended to be holding sites for high-level nuclear waste that does not yet have a permanent storage facility, have been opposed in the likelihood that there never would be a recognized permanent facility, and they would de facto become the permanent storage. We'll have much more on this and other issues related to nuclear industry shenanigans and bailouts in today's featured interview. Continuing with an eye on Washington, D.C., out of the public view and without a single hearing, both chambers of Congress quietly passed legislation and the White House signed into law on March 23rd the renewal of the Price-Anderson Act, which extends and expands the nuclear industry's limited liability protection to the next severe accident by 40 years, until December 31st of 2065. Price-Anderson effectively financially shields the nuclear industry from damage costs caused by the radioactive fallout released in the next severe nuclear accident. To understand the magnitude of this, the cost of nuclear accidents at Chernobyl and Fukushima have exceeded hundreds of billions of dollars. But Price-Anderson limits the U.S. industry's collective cost to just over $16 billion per accident, leaving federal taxpayers liable for the remaining compensation costs. And remember, as we just mentioned, the U.S. government has yet to provide compensation to U.S. citizens caught downwind from nuclear incidents and accidents, and the generations of their offspring who are still sickened and dying of cancer caused by chronic exposure to radioactive fallout from the first Trinity bomb test on July 16, 1945, nearly 79 years ago. NuScale, the company whose small modular reactor project collapsed so spectacularly last November, is, quote, burning cash at the rate of $185 million per year. In a vote of no confidence, on March 22nd, the company's CEO, John Hopkins, sold almost 60,000 of his shares in the company. He had previously announced that NuScale's small modular nuclear reactor project was a, quote, dead horse. And Wells Fargo has declared, "We think investor enthusiasm for small modular nuclear reactors is misguided." We will link to this article by Linda Pence Gunter, who is currently on hiatus from Nuclear Hot Seat, but continues to be a voice within our community. Note that this week, NuScale's stock dropped from $7.50 per share to $4.50 per share, a 55% downslide. Currently, NuScale Power has no customers for its small modular nuclear reactors. A stunning vote of no confidence. Meanwhile, if you want reliable energy, here in California, you should go wind, water, and solar. That's because, as of March 19, the state has exceeded 100% of its energy generation through water, wind, and solar on 11 of the past 12 days. And with the days getting longer and the sun shining for longer, we will have even more electricity generated in a genuinely sustainable way. And now here's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear.
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nom Nuts of the Week.
This one is ugly. Michigan Republican House Member Tim Walberg spoke at a town hall meeting last week about wiping out Gaza and told his constituents that, quote, "It should be like Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Get it over quick," end quote. Whatever your thoughts are on that war, the level of ignorance, cruelty, and flat-out viciousness in Wahlberg's remarks, invoking the U.S. atomic bombings of Japan during World War II that killed 200,000 people, and saying it while discussing his opposition to U.S. humanitarian aid for Gaza, represents an incomprehensible indifference to human suffering. Wahlberg, of course, attempted to dial back his comments with every bully's standard excuse when caught. "Ha ha, just joking. You didn't understand me." He posted this lame excuse for an apologia the day afterwards by writing, "As a child who grew up in the Cold War era, the last thing I'd advocate for would be the use of nuclear weapons." But he did! There is a video of Wahlberg spouting those exact same words, his heinous disregard for human life, and we put it up on our website under this episode, number 667. Wahlberg is clearly on his way to one of Dante's lowest circles of hell. But until he gets there for his eternal damnation, the most we can do here is brand him as this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numb Nuts of the Week.
Over to Japan, where on April 1st, an earthquake with a preliminary magnitude of 6.1 hit Iwate and Aomori prefectures in the northern part of that country. According to the Japan Meteorological Agency, the epicenter was in the northern coastal part of Iwate Prefecture. Iwate is only 140 miles or 225 kilometers north of Fukushima. Now today, April 2nd, just as we were beginning to record this report, we learned of a 7.5 magnitude earthquake in Taiwan, and Japan is reporting that a resulting tsunami did hit two of its southernmost islands. As a seismically active country, Japan deserves to do some serious rethinking of its national nuclear policy. And now, here's our monthly ICANN update on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Hello, I'm Alistair Burnett, Head of Media for ICANN in Geneva, and this is our news update from the campaign for March. This month, we've been doing a lot on the impact the use of nuclear weapons has had and continues to have on people's health and well-being, as well as their environment around the world. In addition to the atomic bombings of Japan in 1945, since then more than 2,000 nuclear weapons have been exploded to test them. Most of these tests were done by the United States and Russia, or the Soviet Union as it then was. But Britain, China, France, India, Pakistan and North Korea also did their share. These tests have contaminated large areas, including people's communities in various parts of the world. In addition to the southwestern United States, Kazakhstan and northern Russia were used for many tests by the Soviet Union. Britain tested its weapons in Australia and Kiribati. France used Algeria and islands in French Polynesia in the Pacific. The US also tested many weapons in the Pacific, in the Marshall Islands specifically. The other countries tended to test on their own territory. March the 1st was the 70th anniversary of the largest ever American test. An H-bomb, 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb used to destroy Hiroshima, was exploded on Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands in 1954. The fallout from the explosion affected the residents on three other atolls who were only evacuated after being exposed to near lethal doses of radiation. The fallout also hit a Japanese fishing vessel, the Lucky Dragon, making the crew sick and killing one of them. This incident triggered a strong reaction around the world, but particularly in Japan, and led, among other things, to the making of the original Godzilla movie, the giant reptilian monster that was awakened and given extra strength by nuclear tests and has appeared in more than 30 films to date. Here in Geneva, the permanent mission of the Republic of the Marshall Islands to the UN hosted a commemorative event for diplomats and civil society. ICANN colleagues were there. March the 5th is the International Day for Disarmament and Non-Proliferation Awareness, and this year, a group of United Nations experts urged states to address the human rights impact of nuclear testing. They called for those rights to be respected and governments to support the people and communities affected. When the media talk about nuclear weapons, they often do this in dry, analytical terms. Who has the most weapons? How big the weapons are? How states use them in their geopolitical stratagems? But this month, the New York Times has started a new series on the threat of nuclear conflict called At the Brink, and the first report was a very good description of what happens when a nuclear weapon explodes. The journalists have been in touch with us for advice and help arranging interviews with survivors of the use and testing of nuclear weapons. And while no piece of journalism always says everything you want it to, this series looks very promising, and it has to be welcomed that an influential media outlet like The Times is doing this. ICANN works to support survivors as well, including through the work under the Nuclear Ban Treaty. The TPNW is an innovative treaty with its provisions mandating countries to support victims and survivors of the use and testing of nuclear weapons. One of our experts is Lisa Jertström. She's been telling me about what the treaty does and how.
It does that through two of its articles, Article 6 and 7, that are actually directed completely to that purpose. So Article 6, that's victim assistance and environmental remediation, which states that states parties that have communities affected by nuclear weapons shall provide victim assistance and take measures towards environmental remediation. And also importantly, other states shall provide assistance to that end. But there is also some talk now amongst states parties of establishing an international trust fund. And depending on the decisions that states will make, maybe at the next meeting of states parties next year, it could also be possible that other states could contribute through the trust fund. That's work in progress still.
And what about Article 7?
So Article 7, it's supposed to be read together with Article 6, right? Because Article 6, it places a lot of responsibility on the states that have communities and environments affected by nuclear weapons, that they shall work to provide assistance and do environmental remediation. And Article 7 is how the treaty guarantees that these states are not left alone with this burden. So other states are committed to work through international cooperation and provide assistance, basically acting in solidarity and taking up the responsibility jointly.
The TPNW obviously has only been in force for 3 years, but the history of nuclear testing goes back to 1945, and there have been over 2,000 nuclear tests, and many people around the world affected, had their health damaged, their environments contaminated. And there have been some national programs, many people would argue inadequate, but national programs to support people. How does the TPNW mandating support for people, how does that interact? How does that support the national programs?
You said this has been going on since 1945, and we've seen just recently we saw the 70th anniversary of the Castle Bravo nuclear test that the U.S. did in the Marshall Islands. And the US has had programs of assistance for people from the Marshall Islands who were affected by this test, or the whole segments of tests in the Marshall Islands, but they haven't been comprehensive. They have only included people from certain atolls, four atolls, while the harms spread way beyond those people and those islands. It's also been based on a fund that has run out of funds. So a lot of damages that's been rewarded through this program has never been paid. Another aspect of this is that it is conditional on continued access, military access for the US to the Marshall Islands. So it's not only about victim assistance and environmental remediation. It's not survivor-centered, and the TPNW and the work on victim assistance and environmental remediation done through this multilateral treaty is a lot more focused on the actual needs of survivors, which is crucial because those are the ones that we should actually look at.
So thanks very much, Lena. That was Lena Hjertstrom speaking to me from Sweden, ending this month's news roundup from ICANN in Geneva.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, listen up. Every week I come on and I remind you how I know you care about getting honest nuclear news, what the show does, how we verify everything, to assure you that the information on this show is as clean, honest, direct, and open as I can possibly make it. At the same time, I ask for your support, donations, because that's the only way this show keeps going, by what you, the listeners, do to help. Basically, you are the financial engine that runs this show. And right now, that engine could use a little more gas, or solar, or wind, because it's a sad fact of life that we cannot survive without your support. As you will hear in today's featured interview, the nuclear industry gets tons of money, obscene amounts of money. We're just asking for a little bit of help from each of you. So if you're grateful for the information you get from Nuclear Hot Seat, now is the time to help us out. If you've ever thought of donating to us, there's no time like the present. In honor of tax season, a reminder that Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that any donations you make are tax deductible. And we make it easy for you to donate. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or if you prefer, send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. You can make it a one-time donation or set up a recurring monthly donation. But whatever you choose to do, please do it now. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to help us out. And know that whatever you can do to help, as always, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Nuclear bailouts keep coming through thick and fast, and there seems to be no end to the nuclear money pit. Here to bring us up to date on exactly what's been going on and how much we are all being financially sucked dry by this industry, I spoke with Kevin Camps. He is Nuclear Waste Watchdog at Beyond Nuclear and a veteran of more than 30 years of work on these issues. Kevin's rundown of the current situation makes the complexities of this ongoing nukester money grab clear and easily understandable. And once you hear what he has to say, you might just be enraged by what these people are getting away with. I know I was. I spoke with Kevin Camps on March 30th, 2024. Kevin Camps, it's always wonderful to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
There is so much going on in the wild and wacky world of nuclear bailouts that I barely know where to start. There seems to have been a massive surge in government subsidies given to major nuclear industry players to save, restore, or expand the number of nuclear reactors or extend their operating lives. Give us a general orientation as to what's going on.
Okay. You know, I should start with some good news because it's what prompted this massive pushback by the industry and our own government against our own interest. So the good news is that beginning in 2012, with the shutdown of a reactor up in Quebec, of all places, Dante Unit 2, there began a record-breaking number of reactor shutdowns in North America. But there have been a dozen in the United States, beginning at Kewaunee, Wisconsin, and most recently at Palisades in Michigan. And sort of in desperation, the industry drew a line in the sand and began a massive lobbying and campaign contribution undertaking, not that they weren't at it before, but what they did is they bought state governments to begin bailing out nuclear power plants that otherwise would have closed. And we're talking about dozens of potential closures that did not happen because these nuclear power plants were bailed out at the state level, beginning in 2016 in New York, when, you know, thankfully, Governor Cuomo and many others forced the shutdown of Indian Point Units 2 and 3. That finally took place in 2020 and 2021, but the ground was laid, the decision was made in 2016. But in exchange for that good news, some very bad news went down. It was a raw political deal. If we're going to shut down two reactors near New York City, we're going to bail out four upstate New York reactors on the Lake Ontario shore at a cost of $7.6 billion over 12 years. This is money from a clean energy fund, supposedly for climate mitigation, that was stolen from renewables like wind and solar and efficiency and storage and given to a single company, this chameleon Exelon Nuclear that is very closely related to Constellation Nuclear. They got all that money in New York State for these four upstate reactors. Shortly after that went down, then by December of 2016, another massive bailout, this time in Exelon's home state of Illinois, headquartered in Chicago, a bailout of $2.35 billion to preserve the operational life of about three reactors at that time. Then in 2021, another $700 million in state bailouts in Illinois, bringing it up to a even $3 billion altogether. And then you've got other states. That was Exelon related in Illinois. You've got other states like New Jersey with a $2.7 billion bailout. Another state, Connecticut, with a $1.65 billion bailout. These were for different companies in Connecticut. Dominion, I believe, owns the Millstone reactor. And a good analysis by Environmental Working Group in 2019 put the total figure at that time at about $14 billion, but still counting. A little bit of good news on all this was that in Ohio, there was a nuclear bailout for more than $1 billion that was passed by the state legislature, signed by the governor in 2019. Long story short, it came out the next year that this was a massive, the biggest in the state's history, racketeering conspiracy, bribery for bailout, a $61 million bribe paid by First Energy Nuclear to the state House Speaker, whose name, oddly, is Larry Householder. And he has gone to prison for 20 years. He was convicted on all charges. So in exchange for $61 million in bribes, Householder essentially gave First Energy more than $1 billion in nuclear bailouts, which, because of the uproar of the scandal, was repealed. But incredibly enough, the coal aspect of that bailout is still on the books. People are paying a coal bailout in Ohio based on this racketeering conspiracy. And these coal plants are from the 1950s, and they were associated with uranium enrichment at places like Paducah, Kentucky, and Portsmouth, Ohio. And incredibly enough, Ohio ratepayers are paying coal bailouts for a coal plant in Indiana, Madison, Indiana. So it's all craziness. But thankfully, that nuclear bailout aspect got repealed. So those were the good old days when a bunch of reactors that would have otherwise shut did not do so because their state governments bailed them out at taxpayer and or ratepayer expense. I say the good old days because since then, laws like the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act of 2021, better known as the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, that had something like $13 billion in nuclear power bailouts in it. And then the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, this was mind-blowing levels of nuclear power bailouts that most people haven't even heard about. But we're talking about a figure of something like $350 billion altogether of nuclear power bailouts of various sorts going forward. And again, it's all to prevent the closure of reactors that can't compete with cheaper sources of electricity like natural gas, which has its downsides, don't get me wrong, but it's cheaper than nuclear, and renewables like wind and solar and energy efficiency and energy storage. They are much cheaper than nuclear, provide the same electricity, actually, because they're cheaper, would provide a lot more electricity for the same cost. So it's a huge lobbying accomplishment by the industry to the detriment of the American people.
Those are some pretty staggering financial numbers. Let's be clear. Where is that money coming from? Is it all from taxpayers and ratepayers?
Well, I can talk about the Palisades reactor in Michigan because I've been focused on it for over 30 years. But most recently, it's really turned into a nuclear nightmare. And it's the most extreme example of all this stuff. So Palisades actually closed for good on May 20th of 2022 under the previous owner, Entergy. But a month before closure, the governor of Michigan, a Democrat, Gretchen Whitmer, floated the trial balloon of, how about we don't shut it? How about if we keep operating it? Maybe we'll find a new company that will keep operating it. Well, Holtec had already been trying to get a hold of the plant, supposedly for decommissioning. And it turned out that a week after they got a hold of it, on June 28th of 2022, they applied in secret to the DOE for many billions of dollars in bailouts for this restart scheme. We wouldn't even know for a couple more months that Holtec was this mystery company that was going to restart Palisades because they said they wanted to decommission it. So they did this con job, this bait and switch trick on us. And all of a sudden, we're in a whole new realm, uncharted territory of risk and expense.
Explain that more.
Just in terms of the money that Holtec has requested for the restart scheme at Palisades, a total of $8.3 billion associated with the restart scheme, $300 million of state taxpayer money, many billions of dollars of federal taxpayer money, and then ratepayer surcharges of about $3.5 billion over a 26-year period. You add it all up, it's $8.3 billion for the restart scheme. But Holtec is pretty ambitious. They also have a small modular reactor development division, and they are trying to get $7.4 billion from the Department of Energy, again, federal taxpayer money, to build small modular reactors at Palisades and its sibling closed and decommissioned nuclear power plant site in northern Michigan called Big Rock Point. $8.3 billion plus $7.4 billion equals $15.7 billion and counting of public subsidies, bailouts, giveaways for renuclearization, a term that Steve Kent came up with, renuclearization of closed nuclear power plant sites, $15.7 billion.
And what are some of the dangers that are involved with starting a nuclear power plant, restarting a nuclear power plant that has already been mothballed?
Yeah, well, that's the much bigger fear is Palisades was among the most risky atomic reactors in the United States when it closed a couple of years ago. Those risks have grown worse since then, if you can believe it, because, you know, they were going to decommission it. They were just going to let it go. They were going to tear down the buildings, deal with the radioactive contamination and waste. So they have not done active safety maintenance on the Palisades plant, as far as we can tell. So that would include things like the steam generators, which were already severely degraded, have not been put into a chemically preservative mode. It's called wet layup. They have accelerated degradation in the last 2 years. You've also got the turbine generator shaft, which is bending under its own weight because they haven't been rotating it, which means if they go to use it again, it could violently explode mechanically in the future and send chunks of shrapnel weighing 500 pounds into the control room at Palisades. And they haven't even done such simple things as operating the valves and the pumps to make sure that they work. And as we know from Three Mile Island, when a valve doesn't work, that can be a problem at a nuclear power plant. So the risks have grown worse since shutdown, but the risks before shutdown were very clear. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission didn't care. The owner of the plant didn't care. They included things like the worst embrittled reactor pressure vessel in the country, which is really saying something. Diablo Canyon Unit 1 has the same problem, just not as bad as Palisades, but it's a major scandal at Diablo, as it should be. And then you've got, I mentioned the steam generators have needed replacement for more than 20 years at Palisades. The reactor vessel closure head has needed replacement at Palisades for more than 20 years. And I'll just mention one more. The control rod drive mechanism seals have been leaking at Palisades since 1972. They've never fixed the problem in any comprehensive way. And it's what forced Palisades to close 11 days earlier than planned because they had their latest failure of one of these seals. And it wasn't worth fixing to just go another week and a half. So these are all pathways to reactor core meltdown at Palisades. And it's sitting on the edge of the largest freshwater supply on planet Earth, the Great Lakes, 21% of the world's surface freshwater.
This is stunning. It has stunned me to silence, which I have edited out. How can we trust, or what trust is there in Holtec to even be able to achieve the restart of a nuclear reactor?
Holtec has never operated an atomic reactor. Holtec has never built an atomic reactor. Holtec's bread and butter since 1986, for the most part, has been radioactive waste management. They make containers for high-level radioactive waste. They do other services like racks for indoor wet storage pools for radioactive waste. They're not very good at it. They have made huge mistakes with quality assurance so that even their high-level radioactive waste containers are of questionable structural integrity, sitting still in on-site storage, let alone going down the rails at 60 plus miles per hour. And that all came to us through whistleblowers like Oscar Shirani at Exelon and Dr. Ross Landsman, NRC, Chicago Regional Office. That's how these quality assurance violations by Holtec came to light. Nothing's ever been done about them. So in addition to its inexperience with reactors, operating them, building them, there's this little problem that Holtec is also a crooked corporation. They have been implicated in a bribery conviction in Alabama at Tennessee Valley Authority's Browns Ferry Nuclear Power Plant. And then when they applied for large tax breaks in New Jersey, I'm talking $260 million in tax breaks, they lied about that bribery conviction. They were asked, have you ever been banned and barred from doing business with a state or federal agency? And they said, no. Well, at that bribery conviction, they were banned from doing business with the Tennessee Valley Authority for a short period of time, 60 days, but they lied about it. And they said, no, that is still an active controversy in New Jersey. The attorney general has appealed to the state Supreme Court to claw back that $260 million of ill-gotten tax breaks. So it's still a live issue. Actually, it wasn't the only lie. Holtec told another lie on a tax break application in New Jersey. They got busted and they got fined $5 million for that second lie. They've been put on a sort of probationary supervision for the next several years. If they're going to deal with the state on these tax breaks, there has to be a state-approved mediator keeping an eye on Holtec to make sure they're not lying anymore. So this is a crooked company that can go on and on with examples, but no, it's not to be trusted. I mean, they lied about decommissioning Palisades. That's how they got their foot in the door. And then all of a sudden, they're not decommissioning it. In fact, that's another aspect of their misbehavior. They've been now busted by the NRC, thanks to a loud clamor from watchdog groups about the misspending of decommissioning trust funds at all of the reactors in their decommissioning fleet. And again, the most egregious example is probably Palisades, where in the first 6 months after they took ownership, somehow Holtec spent $44 million of the decommissioning trust fund, about 10% of the trust fund, doing we don't know what, because they're not doing decommissioning. They haven't even started. They're not really doing anything of significance with spent nuclear fuel management, which is a non-decommissioning activity NRC has allowed them to spend decommissioning trust fund money on, unfortunately. And they've also not done any site restoration, another one of these authorized non-decommissioning activities. We think they're spending the money at a high rate of speed on the restart scheme. And my joke is, well, if they're not spending it on the restart scheme, are they having endangered species caviar for breakfast, lunch, and dinner and washing it down with the most expensive champagne on earth? I mean, what are they spending the money on? And we're waiting in the next days to get a hold of their 2023 decommissioning trust fund expenditures to see if they've continued this high burn rate. Like I said, they've been busted at other plants, for example, funding high school fashion shows, funding parades, doing community public relations, donating to a food bank. These are all, you know, great things, sponsoring sport teams. But they're using decommissioning trust fund money to do it. That money is supposed to clean up radioactive contamination at nuclear power plants that, if it's not cleaned up, is going to hemorrhage out into the environment over time and hurt and kill people. So I think Holtec's attitude is we're going to do as little cleanup as we can possibly get away with, use the money for other things like community relations. Get this one. The NRC has approved lobbying as a non-decommissioning activity for which Holtec can expend decommissioning trust fund money. So if Holtec lobbies the state or federal government to loosen the regulations on decommissioning or use of the decommissioning trust fund, that's a legitimate use of decommissioning trust fund money. It's an indication of how far gone the NRC is. They are a major part of the problem here.
Why is it that we haven't been hearing about this, let alone with anything close to the complexity with which you are presenting it here?
Well, we just survived a nuclear love fest on steroids at Palisades the other day on March 27th. The energy secretary came to town. the governor came to town. DOE announced its $1.52 billion with a B dollar nuclear loan guarantee for the restart at Palisades, the first of the big money, but just the beginning. Like I said, $8.3 billion altogether proposed between federal and state money, including ratepayers. The media coverage, there were a lot of media there, and I've reviewed as much as I could get a hold of, and it joined the love fest. It joined the joyride. They didn't have much in the way of opposition, and I didn't sleep much this week trying to push back against all this. And we did get a little bit of pickup in some of the media. And like I said, I've been doing this for 32 years at Palisades. So if the media doesn't know who I am, then there's something wrong with the media. And I think it's fair to say there's something wrong with the media. They are in large part a stenography service for the nuclear power industry. There's exceptions. I'm thankful that there are exceptions, but it's a part of the problem. It's why the public has been led to believe that somehow nuclear is a part of the solution to the climate crisis, when in fact, it's actually the opposite. It's going to waste so much money and so much time and not solve the climate crisis that we're going to be in real trouble. Compliments of nuclear propagandists.
I see the nuclear propaganda come through every week in massive amounts, and it's all fueled by a very carefully calibrated propaganda machine within the nuclear industry to just keep cranking it out. Let's look at some of the other locations where this has been happening. You mentioned New Jersey. What has been the situation there?
The figure that I have from that Environmental Working Group report from 2019 is $2.7 billion in state-level subsidies for reactors like Hope Creek, New Jersey. And what's significant here, and it's true of many of these states, is that these bailouts at the state level went down under Democratic governors, including Phil Murphy in New Jersey, who's actually done some good stuff when it comes to Holtec's misbehavior. He's been calling them out for several years on these lies on the state tax break applications. And the attorney general there is going after Holtec right now as we speak in the state Supreme Court. But at the same time, the Democratic governor of New Jersey supported this state level bailout. And you know what's significant about the Salem and Hope Creek nuclear power plant in New Jersey is that it's very close, just across Delaware Bay from Wilmington, Delaware. And, you know, there's some famous people from Wilmington, Delaware, like Joe Biden, for example. So 15 miles from Wilmington, Delaware, Joe Biden's political headquarters is a very dangerous nuclear power plant complex. You've got the Hope Creek reactor, you've got Salem units 1 and 2. And it just so happens that the CRAC 2 report, Calculation of Reactor Accident Consequences, which NRC commissioned and Sandia National Lab carried out in 1982, some of the worst casualties downwind, downstream of reactor meltdowns that have been predicted are in Wilmington, Delaware, because the population density is so high and big cities like Wilmington and Philadelphia are so nearby. So it's an indication of how the safety risks and the nuclear bailouts are kind of flip sides of the same coin. These very dangerous reactors would thankfully close down. We would have dodged catastrophic bullets, except for the fact that, no, we're going to keep them going with massive infusions of public money. I call it radioactive Russian roulette. And guess who's paying for the game? The public is paying for the game unwittingly, and also being lied to, like we've talked about, from the nuclear propaganda, that it's all safe, it's all clean, it's going to solve the climate crisis. I one time heard Dan Hirsch on a debate with a nuclear spokesman years and years ago. And the nuclear spokesman said something about being the solution to the climate crisis. And Dan, in his way, there was this silence. And then he said, you know, I actually care about the climate. And it was so true. It was obviously that this guy was just spinning. And I've heard this phrase, spinning the splitting of the atom. It comes out of Nevada. They do more spinning of the splitting of the atom than they do splitting of the atom. And it's all about money, vast amounts of money. And of course, as Alfred Meyer has pointed out, it's all about the bomb. They denied from Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace speech in 1953 at the United Nations that no, nuclear weapons are one thing, nuclear power is a whole different thing. It's Atoms for Peace. There's no connection. Well, fast forward to 2017, this desperate time when these state bailouts are going down, Ernest Moniz, who is Obama's energy secretary, comes right out and says it. No, we need to subsidize nuclear power in order to maintain our nuclear weapons arsenal. We need the personnel with the knowledge and the know-how. We need the infrastructure in place. We need to subsidize nuclear power in order to maintain our nuclear weapons arsenal. And he behaves that way to this day. He's the head of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, which claims to be against nuclear weapons proliferation, but are very in favor of nuclear power promotion, which is schizophrenic, of course, and contradictory and self-defeating on its face. That's Ernest Moniz. But he did away with any illusions about some kind of separation between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. He said, no, they're flip sides of the same coin.
One of the earliest awarenesses that I had when I started producing Nuclear Hot Seat was that the United States government in the beginning of the atomic age was responsible for generating all of the plutonium, creating all of the plutonium that was used in weapons, which was costing them massive amounts of money. So they reframed it as, oh, this is really something that can be used by a utility to split the atom and generate heat and boil the water and run the steam generators. And so fobbed it off on the public, as opposed to it being a straight government payment in order to create the plutonium. And in that way, made it seem like the atoms for peace, the positive use, quote unquote, of the nuclear reactors was in the public's good, as opposed to it being a backdoor way of just making sure that we can make as many weapons as we want and never run out of plutonium.
Well, I mean, once Eisenhower gave that speech, they couldn't get away with using commercial reactors to make the military plutonium. So the U.S. government and the U.S. military, under the supervision of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, they did have military production reactors at places like Hanford, Washington. That's where the plutonium for the bombs was coming from. Thus, days before Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace speech, there was a consortium of companies, including Detroit Edison, who were pushing the Fermi Unit 1 project at the time. This is 1953. This document, days before Atoms for Peace, like you just said, their idea at Fermi 1 was to make plutonium for weapons and, get this, to make dirty bomb ingredients, high-level radioactive waste for use in dirty bombs. That was their vision for how to make money at Fermi 1. All of a sudden, Eisenhower gives a speech, and I'd be fascinated to know about the debate that was going on behind the scenes at that moment. Now, all of a sudden, they have to make electricity. It's all about electricity. That's how we're going to make money. And oh, by the way, it's a breeder reactor. It's going to breed plutonium they had bought for weapons. But now they do this spin job, and it's not plutonium for weapons anymore. Now we're going to use the plutonium that we're breeding for more nuclear reactor fuel to make electricity. So that's how Fermi 1 went forward. Then they had the meltdown in 1966, so it went away. How much radioactivity got out, anybody can guess. There is disease and death in that area. That's probably at higher rates than should have been expected. So there's this fascinating history of illusions and lies and deceptions. In fact, Arjun Makajani's book from 1999, The Nuclear Power Deception, is a must read because it gets into this. You know, Strauss, Chairman Louis Strauss of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, who just won an Oscar. Actually, Robert Downey won the Oscar for depicting this guy during the Manhattan Project, but he went on to be chairman of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. He was the one who gave the infamous statement that nuclear power would be too cheap to meter, which was a lie at the time. And Arjun Makajani's book documents that they knew that nuclear power was going to be exorbitantly expensive before Strauss gave that statement. So they have been lying from the beginning.
Two more states to go over where the bailouts have been happening somewhat egregiously. Here in California is a good example of the 180-degree nuclear turnaround regarding Diablo Canyon. It was supposed to be shut down, and now it's not supposed to be shut down. Walk us through that one.
Gavin Newsom has a lot of explaining to do. He did a 180 on this issue. He was at the table as lieutenant governor when Pacific Gas and Electric initiated the shutdown agreement. They initiated the shutdown agreement. They sat down with politicians, municipalities, unions, environmental groups, and they agreed to shut down at the end of the 40-year license. That would be 2024 and 2025, two units. I think Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm, who's a former governor and attorney general of the state of Michigan, has had a huge hand in all this. She was the first one to float Diablo Canyon, not shutting down, but instead continuing to operate early in her tenure as Energy Secretary. And I think it was some months later before Gavin Newsom started talking the same way. So fast forward, I believe it was in late summer to late 2022, but it's all a blur anymore. The state of California under Gavin Newsom and a Democratic legislature approves $1.4 billion in state giveaways to Diablo Canyon, followed by the Department of Energy giving Diablo $1.1 billion in civil nuclear credits for a grand total of $2.5 billion. And the fight is on. I mean, hats off to Mothers for Peace, their attorney, Diane Curran. They're challenging all this big time. And one of the main safety issues is embrittlement of the reactor pressure vessel at Diablo Canyon Unit 1. These proponents of keeping Diablo operating are flying blind. They don't even know how embrittled the reactor pressure vessel is because they haven't done real-world physical data examinations of it. And looking at Japan, after Fukushima Daiichi nuclear catastrophe began in 2011, there was a test of the actual embrittlement levels at Genkai Unit 1, Japan's worst embrittled reactor. They actually pulled some metal capsules to see how embrittled it was. They determined that the embrittlement was much worse than their hypotheses and their computer models had predicted. They immediately shut it down for good. It was permanently closed in response to this information. So the approach in the United States at Diablo Canyon Unit 1, at Palisades and other embrittled reactors has been, we don't want to know. We don't want to know how embrittled it is. And they just double down on their rosy computer modeling and their optimistic hypotheses. And we have sailed very deeply into embrittlement risk territory. We don't even know how bad it is.
You mentioned some of the information about Ohio's nuclear situation earlier, but there's much more to go into. Explain, please.
The tentacles of this bribery racketeering conspiracy are still being revealed. There are new charges against former Speaker of the Ohio State House, Larry Householder. He's in prison as we speak on a 20-year sentence. He is facing new state charges. And then there were charges just recently within the last several weeks filed against former top dogs at First Energy Nuclear, including the CEO, including the top lobbyist in the company. There are still criminal charges unfolding all these years. The scandal was revealed in June or July of 2020. So here we are going on 4 years later. There's still charges being filed, especially at the state level now. But again, you know, it wasn't just the money. It wasn't just the bribery and the bailouts, but it's the safety risks. So at Davis-Besse, one of the most dangerous atomic reactors in the country, it's had a half dozen near misses with catastrophe over the decades. And as we speak, it has a severely cracked shield building, the final line of defense on the structural containment to hold in a meltdown and its hazardous radioactivity. The shield building is severely cracked, so much so that a small additional load, as they say in NRC parlance, something like an earthquake, could crumble the shield building, this massive structure. And there are safety systems down below on the outside of the shield building that could get taken out in such a circumstance. So incredibly enough, the containment at Davis-Besse could initiate the meltdown that the containment then fails to contain. That's the situation at Davis-Besse. Has been, we've known about the cracking for 13 years now. And we fought very hard beginning in 2011 to try to stop the 20-year license extension. We didn't even know about the scandal yet. They tried to get a bailout at the federal level. They tried various times at the state level. We kept fending it off. And finally, in 2019, they rammed this House Bill 6 through the state legislature. We would find out a year later, based on this bribery, racketeering scandal. But the safety risks remain. These reactors still operate. And that was one thing I wanted to say about these bailouts. Dave Kraft refers to it as nuclear hostage taking. Companies like Exelon in Illinois and other states, First Energy in Ohio, what they would do is they would threaten to close the reactors. And they would point out that all these revenues to local host municipalities would go away. All these jobs would go away. They're doing the same thing at Palisades right now. And then it turns out that many of these nuclear hostage-taking threats were bogus. So in Illinois, the deadline for the bailout would come and go. They wouldn't shut the reactor, or they would even file the paperwork to permanently shut the reactor and then pull it back from the NRC. Dave Kraft actually asked the NRC, so can companies pull back these shutdown certifications? And NRC said, oh yeah, sure. Yeah. All they got to do is ask. And that's what we're seeing at Palisades, is they have never restarted a closed reactor. NRC has had 7 major technical meetings with Holtec trying to figure out, how do you reverse the certification of permanent shutdown, which Entergy filed on June 13th of 2022. NRC is only too happy to help Holtec figure out how to reverse the shutdown on paper. But the safety risks aren't being addressed. And that's another thing it's hard to wrap your head around. All this money we've been talking about, there's no requirement that any of it be used for repairs, replacements, refurbishments, maintenance. It can go into the pocket of these companies as pure profit, and they just keep running the reactor into the ground.
It seems that the nuclear industry gets whatever they want, that the laws, the regulations, the NRC, state governments, the federal government, everything is brought into alignment to serve what they want, with no chance at contradiction except for a couple of activists scattered around in at least one podcast. It brings me to a central question that's been popping up for me, and that is, are we, this country, this world, owned by the nuclear industry?
Well, they think they own us, and it seems that way a lot of times, but sometimes we win. I mean, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times on March 27th. I've described the $1.52 billion DOE giveaway to Holtec at Palisades. They had that big love fest on camera. Later that night, an email came through from a colleague in New Mexico. A federal appeals court in New Orleans, the Fifth Circuit, a 3-judge panel, had just vacated NRC's license for Holtec's proposed dump in New Mexico. So this appeals court has already vacated the license for Interim Storage Partners dump in Texas, and then sustained that ruling on March 20th by a vote of 9-7. The en banc full circuit bench of judges sustained that earlier 3-judge panel ruling from August of 2023. That was against the Texas dump. But our allies at Fasken Land and Minerals Limited and the Permian Basin Land and Royalty Owners said to the court, to a new 3-judge panel, hey, if the Texas dump is illegal for all these reasons that you found, well, this New Mexico dump is also illegal for the very same reasons. And the 3-judge panel just came back on March 27th and said, yes, the Holtec dump is also illegal. The license is vacated. So I imagine the victory celebrations at Holtec were suddenly brought to a screeching halt that night. The blocking of their dump in New Mexico is huge. People have been fighting it for a long time. And we're still waiting for the DC Circuit Court of Appeals to rule. We just had oral arguments on March 5th against Holtec's dump in New Mexico. There already is a split between the circuits on the Texas dump. We hope to prevail at the DC Circuit on the New Mexico dump, but we'll see what happens. But the other side now has 90 days from the ruling to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And we've talked about their vast resources, Holtec, Interim Storage Partners, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They have vast resources and they don't like to lose. So chances are high that one of those parties are going to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. So we're going to have to defend our victory in court, not only at the Supreme Court, but I'm afraid on Capitol Hill, because the lobbying juggernaut of this industry, when they lose in court, they go across the street to the Capitol and try to get the law changed. We've seen that happen where we win, but we lose because they just changed the law. So we have to defend our victories in every branch of our federal government, and as we've been talking about, in our state houses as well.
For those of us who are clearly opposed to this nuclear money pit and the full court press of the propaganda taking away the chances for even closing these embrittled, these dangerous nuclear reactors, what can those of us who listen to Nuclear Hot Seat, who are concerned about the issue, do to try and help stop this?
Engage in your democracy at every level as best you can, and also have fun at it. I mean, Michael Marriott, who was the executive director at NIRS and passed some years ago, would always try to insert elements of fun. Whatever it is you like to do, bring it to this cause. If you like films, host a film series about anti-nuclear victories and efforts. If you like music, organize a concert. If you like going to the farmer's market, set up an info booth at the farmer's market with information about the local nuclear fight. We just got to engage and have fun. And the stakes are so high that it can get paralyzing and traumatizing pretty quick. But we just got to try to keep our heads above water and have fun while saving the world.
And pat each other on the back in the process, which is so important to keeping us in good heart and moving forward.
Along those lines, I mean, keep some perspective too. I mean, Richard Nixon gave a speech where he envisioned 1,000 reactors in the United States by the year 2000. They ended up building something like 131, and we've closed 39 of those. And we've stopped the Yucca Mountain dump. We're hopefully going to stop this Texas and this New Mexico dump. We do have victories. We had a record-breaking number of reactor shutdowns from 2012 until just recently. So we just got to keep at it. And hopefully this house of cards called the nuclear industry will fall under its own weight. What we're trying to do is prevent that from literally happening at a place like Diablo Canyon in an earthquake. So those are the stakes.
Kevin Camps, it's always great having you here to fill us in on so many of the details that can't escape us. And I look forward to speaking with you again in the near future on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. It was fun. I look forward to it.
Kevin Camps is Nuclear Waste Watchdog at Beyond Nuclear. Kevin provided links to several articles and studies that further explain many of the points that he made during our talk. He also provided that Environmental Working Group chart that shows exactly how much money those nuclear bailouts have amounted to. Not that it's going to stop there. Remember, nuclear is forever. Links to all that information will be up on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 667.
Activists, shout out.
The International Uranium Film Festival continues on its North American tour, racking up successes wherever it goes. The festival just left a spectacular 5 days in Chicago and will be in Spokane, Washington on April 3rd and 4th, Vancouver, British Columbia, April 8th through 12th, Seattle, April 12th through 14th, before closing out in Las Vegas, April 30th and May 1st. For the full schedule, go to uraniumfilmfestival.org and click on the tab for USA 2024. And on April 12th, if you're in Santa Barbara, the film festival, in conjunction with UC Santa Barbara's conference, Global Legacies on Anti-Nuclear Activism, will present Heidi Huttner's award-winning film, Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island. I will be there as the representative of the film festival to introduce the film and afterwards interviewing Heidi and leading a Q&A with the audience. There's no charge, but you do have to reserve tickets because there are only a limited number of seats available. We'll have that link up on the website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 667. That's Friday, April 12th at 8:30 p.m. on the UCSB campus, McCune Conference Center Theater. Please come by and say hello. I would love to see you in person. I will also have copies of my book available, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat, and I will be signing copies. I look forward to seeing you. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it so simple. Go to the website, NuclearHotSeat.com, and you cannot miss the yellow box that pops up that asks you for your first name and your email address. Fill that out. That goes into our database, and every week you will get one, just one, email with a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. That way, you never need miss a single episode of the show. Now, you can help us out in another way. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information via email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, always, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help and will truly appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Nuclear Hot Seat and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, the names of any guests whose comments you use, and, if you're citing me, mention me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with a date that it's over, because once it starts, it is never over. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.